some glitches, but welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. We're at year's end, and this is a time to assess how we did in 2012 and how we might do better in the new year. It was a year of tragedy because of all the gun violence in our country and also all the innocent civilians in the tribal areas of Pakistan who were killed by our drones. And it was also an exasperating year, weren't it? Even for an election year. It's downright unreal that global climate disruption was not even mentioned during three presidential debates at this late stage of the escalating destruction. And not the slightest mention by anyone of debating a carbon tax, even though the global climate disruption, excuse me, there's an interruption. Anyway, Matt, try the old number. I'm sorry, folks, our guest had extenuating circumstances this morning, and he's trying valiantly and courageously to join us, which looks like it's going to happen. So back to what I wanted to say in my opening comments. So exasperating about what didn't get mentioned in Washington this year. You know, even though global climate disruption is here now and likely to get much worse. And also notice that no one made a peep among the congressional Democrats when President Obama proposed earlier this month reducing the formula for the cost of living adjustments in Social Security checks. A lot of people just hanging on by a thread with those Social Security checks. That is, he and the Democrats support the option that instead of raising or abolishing the cap on taxable income for the Social Security tax, they'll just cut the cost of living increases. But that flat tax for Social Security should be democratically applied equally to all of everyone's earned income. And further, I saw a protester sign the other day that said, quote, "Educate the masses!" Exclamation point. Uh-huh. That's a growing crisis. We were doing pretty well in the 1970s as a nation of offering qualified students, even those not born with money, the opportunity to go through good public higher education. But today, millions of young Americans are seeing that door slammed in their faces. We need to restore the funding to public higher education. And very soon. Also, we need to restore the revenue streams that were so badly damaged with the Bush tax cuts. It's kind of outrageous what's happening with that. I realize that these issues are complex, but we really cannot allow them to be largely unmentionable subjects in Washington, as is Medicare for All. So let's focus in the new year on getting just these five items onto the discussion table and squawking if they're taken off. Number one, where's the carbon tax? Number two, democratize the Social Security tax. Number three, restore the revenue streams. Number four, fund community colleges and public universities because people are sinking fast. And number five, the big one, without which nearly every vote on nearly every issue is corrupted by the ongoing desperate need to please the big donors for campaign contributions. Number five is campaign finance reform. Well, Washington may be endlessly maddening these days, but closer to home, a lot of people are seeing what needs to be done, joining with others to do it, and then enjoying the ever-widening circles that ripple out from local and regional initiatives. and we're going to be hearing about that now. My guest today, 2 days after Christmas, is a wise man bearing gifts. He's Peter Warshall, an ecologist, activist, and essayist whose work centers on conservation and conservation-based development. He holds a PhD in biological anthropology from Harvard, and he also studied cultural anthropology in Paris with Levi Strauss as a Fulbright scholar. Peter Warshall's research interests include natural history, natural resource management, especially watersheds and wastewater practices, conservation biology, biodiversity assessments, environmental impact analysis, and conflict resolution and consensus building among divergent economic and cultural special interest groups. He's worked as a consultant for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees in Ethiopia and for USAID and other organizations in 10 other African nations. He's worked with the Tohono O'odham and Apache people of Arizona and has advised municipal governments and corporations. Peter Warshall was also associated with a classic publication from the 60s and beyond. He was the sustainability and anthropology editor of one of the later editions of the Whole Earth Catalog series. And he also served as an editor for several years of the magazine Whole Earth Review. He recently co-directed an extremely interesting project called Dreaming New Mexico. Peter Warshall, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi. Well, thank you, Charlene.
Later on now, we're going to get into your ideas about biodiversity, but I'd like to begin with your telling us about the Dreaming New Mexico project, of which you were the founding co-director in recent years. And
sure.
I think there's so much there that's relevant to our various situations all over the country. I'm particularly interested in this work because the basic ideas of building up community and regional economics and starting that by making an inventory of what food and products are being imported into an area that might be substituted with locally sourced food and products has been part of the green, capital G, economic model since the 1980s, one that I and many others have tried to further. And it has been put into use, mainly at the local level. But the Dreaming New Mexico project is the first time I've seen any group try to apply these principles to an entire state and to go much further. Your project there is not only an eco-social approach with a lot of solid data and economic strategizing, but it seems to me to also have a cultural, ecological, and spiritual depth to it. And I'd like to orient the listeners by reading just two sentences about the project from their website, which is dreamingnewmexico.org. And this statement is entitled, Creating Intimacy with Our Land, Waters, and History. Over the centuries, the land and peoples of New Mexico have been wounded and have wounded each other. Dreaming New Mexico believes that creating intimacy with our land, waters, and history, and how they all work together, is the best way to help heal these past wounds and revitalize our economy, energy system, and farms, and to continue our grand traditions of art and music and crafts, and restore our natural heritage. So it seems that this deep thinking came out of your chosen starting point, which was the notion for a need for sanctuary in these times. Would you tell us about that?
Sure. What we did is, and what I think is unique about the Dreaming New Mexico project, is that we started out by talking to anybody who was involved with food or energy. Ranchers, farmers, agency employees, church food volunteers, nonprofit activists, anyone we could find. But what we did is we didn't ask them about their current political work. or their current tasks, we asked them what their dreams were. And we said to them, what do you really want? And when you want something, what is, forget about the local entanglement with politics and the difficulties of the hot frying pan and trying to get legislation through. Just tell us what you really want and try to purify your desires. In other words, to take a sanctuary or a refuge from the everyday work that we all are doing and try to remember why we wanted to do it and what success would look like. You get so involved that you with realistic solutions and strategizing that you can forget what your fundamental reasons were for wanting to do something and what you actually want to accomplish. And sometimes you even get lost in the work, and so you are doing something that you actually didn't even intend to do when you began. And so what we did is ask people what their, if they went into a sanctuary or if they had refuge from burnout, what it would look like. And we began to just take notes and talk to people and come up with various themes that people wanted. And then we started the project. And so we didn't start with our own particular agenda. We wanted to hear what the dreams were and then lay out those dreams in some practical manner. So, for instance, in energy, people really wanted, you know, rooftop energy. They wanted to decentralize energy. But other people really wanted to make sure that the distribution lines in New Mexico didn't go past the oil and gas and coal, but went past the best places for solar power and wind and geothermal, which is big in New Mexico. So we began to redo, for instance, the transmission lines and dream up the transmission lines that would look just perfect for harvesting solar energy or wind energy. And that had never been done because everyone was always fighting about this particular high voltage transmission line or that one. And then with food, we understood that New Mexico is so big that actually we had to divide it up into agro-eco regions, and that was a new concept. But agriculture has been going on in New Mexico for thousands of years, and each section had different ways of growing different crops that were better. So we people loved it, and each agro-eco region now has decided to form its own agro-eco region hub because farmers were driving all over the state, I mean thousands of miles, and going home with empty trucks when they could just go now to an agro-eco-regional hub and leave their food there, and then from there it was redistributed. So that saved energy, saved, you know, greenhouse gases, and it also began to create a community in each agro-eco-region. For instance, the Ogallala Plains is in the eastern part of the state, but the Rocky Mountains are in the northern part of the state. And in the southern part of the state, almost all the water comes from groundwater rather than from the Rio Grande. And so people began to understand how to balance the food for the whole state by each area beginning to specialize in what it was good at and not having, you know, a kind of haphazard understanding of what, where their food came from. Those were the kinds of dreams, and inside the dreams we found tools. One of the really important tools to New Mexico is having biocultural foods, like blue corn. The chili industry, of course, is very big. And so we found out that even if they weren't the best places or the perfect places to grow things, we had to respect the cultures. There are 14 Native American tribes, you know, many migrations of Spanish and Mexican peoples into New Mexico, bringing their own cultural food with them. So that was part of the dream, was biocultural foods, was saving farms and ranches, stopping them from turning into subdivisions. The the food security, in other words, safe food, enough food, easily accessed food, was very important to everybody. It didn't matter which, if you had a huge farm of, you know, 20,000 acres, or if you had a small farm of 5 acres. And so anyway, the dreaming process really brought out what people were willing to give their passion to and spend time with.
Mm-hmm. So. And then, well, there was so much interesting on the website. I guess it was interesting because you got rather far into figuring out how the energy system could really be changed into using a lot of renewables. But you started out by saying this is not a state that's very far along in that at all.
No.
So you were really starting, I mean, for other people to say, well, I don't know, we're one of the more, you know, laggard states on that. You were also working in an area that wasn't jump-started on that, right?
Yeah, no, definitely not. We were lucky because Richardson was governor at that time, and he opened the doors to us, actually. We got a lot of data from the Energy Department, and he encouraged us to work kind of as almost a shadow government or a parallel government that was working on dreams, where, of course, he had to work with one of the largest oil and gas industries in the country, and so he couldn't quite work just with dreams. And so we were able to, you know, go and look at, for instance, there's a transmission line that was set up now between Arizona and New Mexico that is going to be changed because people now are aware the transmission lines kind of dictate what kind of energy development occurs. And before that, everyone was, you know, focused on let's have solar energy or let's have wind energy, but they weren't thinking about the transmission lines. And so now we're in this new kind of stage of, if you want to call it political activism, where everybody in many of the states in the West are getting together to understand, okay, if New Mexico can produce its own wind energy, where should it go, you know, to earn money for the people in the state if you're going to export it, or how can we use it to substitute for coal? About 80% of New Mexico still is on coal because of the Four Corners Project. So we, and that was another part of the dream. People were always thinking 2 to 3 years, maybe 5 years at the most. And we sat back and said, okay, no, dream 20 years. And because 20 years is actually kind of a cycle in American politics. Mm. And so we said, okay, let's try to do this. And so what would we like 20 years from now, for instance, the transmission lines to look like, and, you know, how many rooftop solar, which gets rid of transmission lines, do we really want, and where can we most do them? So right now, the Navajo Nation, after this project, is experimenting with putting solar energy on all of its roofs for the local equivalent of counties within the Navajo Nation. And people are beginning to try to figure out how to make microgrids in Albuquerque. So, you know, it's going to take 20 years because so much has to be changed, you know, to accomplish this. But it's good to have that kind of dream because if you go back to it, you know, every year or two, you remind yourself what you actually desire and what success might look like. So, you know, it really happened. It was very important in food because, in general, every state produces maybe 2 to 4% of all the food consumed within the state.
Yeah, that was shocking.
Yeah, and that's, well, it's in part in New England, you have snow all winter. You can't grow things in snow, so.
Uh-huh.
And in New Mexico, it's a very arid state and getting more arid with climate change. And so, and then in general, you know, of course, the United States doesn't grow coffee and
yeah.
doesn't grow agaves for tequila or chocolate. So you're always going to...
I just want to explain, while I was laughing when you said 20 years, it's a political cycle because that should be more famous. Study by Professor Minsky many years ago said he looked at the economic history of the United States and determined that every 20 years or so, the banks put a torch to the economy.
Really?
So we do seem to have a 20-year cycle. And, yeah, let's keep moving into this economic matter then, this idea with the food production and what you figured out with the value chains.
Well, value chains were really important tool that everybody, again, cross from, you know, ranchers down to gardeners really liked. And what it simply says is, let's track every step from production to consumption to waste and to the in food. And so, for instance, excuse me, pecans are a very big product of New Mexico. They ship, for instance, 5 million tons of pecans every year to China.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's just gigantic. And so Georgia, Texas, and New Mexico are big pecan growers. And so we were wondering, well, why don't farmers or orchardists grow organic pecans? And what we found out is that it was near impossible to get enough organic fertilizer. And the shipping costs for organic fertilizer were just too high to make it worthwhile. On the other hand, the second largest agricultural industry in New Mexico is dairy. And so there was all this dairy waste, but the dairy waste couldn't be used by organic pecan farmers because it had too many antibiotics and other stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was really missing was the ability first to make more organic dairies, but also the ability to change the fertilizer and compost it at a high enough temperature that it could be used by organic pecan growers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was found out by going through each step, crop by crop, of each product. Mm-hmm. And seeing where the weak point was, and then offering to some entrepreneur to begin an industry or a project to convert, for instance, dairy waste, which was an environmental problem, into fertilizer that could be used by the pecan growers,
mm-hmm.
who could make a lot more money selling organic pecans
mm-hmm.
than can regular. So
mm-hmm.
that's what value chains are really about. And it has to be crop, really almost crop specific. Another really wonderful thing that in part came out of our project, although not directly, was that we found that although all the apples in the local schools were coming from Washington State, while there was a huge apple growing community in the Rockies of New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and the reason, going through the value chain again, was that the apple growers in New Mexico could not afford to buy a sorter because the school system will only take one diameter apples that have been washed and polished. That's a rule. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't meet that criteria. So, hello? The New Mexico Economic Department went out and bought them one of those machines.
Yeah.
And a co-op was formed among the apple growers. And now every year, almost, 20% of the apples that go into the school system and it's growing are local apples.
Wow. And I love that spot. I noticed on the website, or maybe it was in one of your video talks on their dreamingnewmexico.org website, which we should add is a project of Bioneers. Anyway, the spot was where you got the state government to agree to not only buy local produce for state institutions like schools and office building cafeterias, but to increase that amount by 2% a year. That was very smart to gradually keep upping it. We're going to have to pause for the break here, but
sure.
Before we leave this particular subject, I just want to make sure that everyone is informed that there's a free PDF you can download from the website dreamingnewmexico.org, and it's entitled Dreaming Planet Earth, Methods for Mapping Future Food and Energy Systems at the Local Level. And the project says this about that PDF on their methods. We created it in response to many requests from around the country and the world as to how we went about future mapping for the age of renewables and the age of local food sheds and a fair trade state at the local level. The free methodology of this award-winning project gives you practical tools, insights, and tips on the complex process of how to map not just the existing systems, parenthesis, in all their glorious dysfunction, close parenthesis, but more importantly, how to dream what Buckminster Fuller called the preferred state. Imagine the year is 2020 and we've done everything right. What would an appropriate energy or food system look like? All right. Well, we'll pause now for the break. This is Charlene Spratnak speaking with my guest, Peter Warshall, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnak speaking with my guest, Peter Warshall. Well, let's move into your thoughts about biodiversity. You've been a consultant in that area for decades, I know, and I'm particularly taken by your idea about adopting a species of concern. What's that about?
The only way that we are going to keep the number of species on the planet alive that exists right now is if people make a personal commitment. And the old way of doing it, the traditional way of doing it, is that people would adopt an animal as their guide, as their kind of sentient being guide. They would be their totemic guide. And that would happen when an animal or a plant presented itself to each other. So, for instance, in my life, jaguars most recently came into my life when a Mexican biologist walked into the house and said, look, there are 180 jaguars left in northern Mexico. They used to be up at the Grand Canyon. They used to be across to the Colorado River and Texas all the way to Missouri at one point. And we're trying to save these last 180 jaguars. Can you help me? And I said, well, I don't really know very much about jaguars. I've worked mostly in Africa. And he said, well, we just have to begin to understand how to create a sanctuary or a refuge for them. Now, that happens again and again in people's lives, but they don't quite pay attention to it, where an animal or a plant will appear show itself to them, and they suddenly get a moment where it grabs your heart, and then we just go back in our lives. But E.O. Wilson, who's the kind of professor of biodiversity, figured out that if one person in every 6,000 adopted a rare or endangered or a species of concern, and they just lived with it and followed it, you know, every month, seeing how it's doing, seeing what it needed, seeing how they could help it, that we could probably substantially kind of succeed in saving one of now the sixth largest extinction event that's ever occurred in the history of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of, I once was working on a little 8-ounce squirrel called the Mount Graham red squirrel, and I just was trying to save it. There were only a couple of hundred left, and it turned out that they lived on an Apache sacred mountain, and that the threat to the squirrel was that the Vatican and the Max Planck Institute in Germany and the University of Arizona wanted to cut the top of the forest, their forest, to produce telescopes to study the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had got into a huge conflict between what has priority, the heavens or the earth. And I wound up with a whole bunch of Apache spiritual leaders in the Vatican trying to argue our case. And they didn't know that I spoke French, and the language of the Vatican is French. So I was hearing both sides as the Apaches were trying to plead for their mountain. And so it was the largest coalition of Native American groups, about 24 tribes and conservationists.
What year was that?
It's still going on right now.
Oh.
Now, it started in 1988 and has been, right now, it's a over a 20-year battle. And, there's lots of in and outs with the Forest Service and, you know, the University of Arizona spent $1 million to free the project from an environmental impact statement and from following the Historic Preservation Act and two of the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, and they got it on as one of those riders that people talk about that are supposed to disappear in Washington but actually haven't disappeared. And that said that this project was completely free of all the laws that Congress had passed. And so it's a very bitter controversy still going on, and combines kind of the spiritual commitment of the Apaches to do no harm to creatures with kind of the conservationist attempt to do no harm and maintain biodiversity. So, I mean, I think that really people have to just open themselves up to when a creature or a plant presents themselves to them and not ignore it. I mean, that's basically, you know, we ignore non-human species. And I've kind of taken a vow. I made it up, the vow. It's a little bit zenny, but I vowed that the creatures on the planet are numberless, but I would take each and every one as my teacher. And that way I keep on learning new things from every animal, you know, especially jaguars. You get to know a lot that comes across your path. And, you know, and one thing I did want to say is that we are, in a sense, all communities. We're just beginning to learn about that, but there are the number of microbe species that live with our
bodies. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about, this bigger meaning of biodiversity. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there. I mean, the number of cells in our body, 10 to 1, are microbes that are not part of our own tissues. And every living being is actually a community like that. And so when you say we're taking care of the health of the planet or biodiversity, we're actually trying to take care of our own bodies, which are pretty much a huge biodiversity community. And we run across the same problems. Do we want to just be a steward of our own bodies? Do we want to use heavy-duty medicine and be kind of domineering over our bodies and managers? Or do we want to be, in a way, servants of our bodies, you know, talking to our bodies like I was talking about, talking to other animals and learning, and see what the body asks for? And so, in a sense, we're, that there's been an artificial distinction between taking care of our own bodies and taking care of the body of the earth, or Gaia. And, you know, we're seeing that a lot, even in cancer treatment, where now the cancer treatment used to be like a war, and I'm going through, you know, where the howitzers are in chemotherapy are trying to knock out the cancer cells, while other people are working towards, I'm using Chinese medicine, where they're trying to build up the immune system and say, all we're doing is helping the creatures in your body that are, and the cells in your body that are already there. And so we're finding that we probably need, at least, you know, in the near future, both. We need heavy-duty stuff, and we need to understand how to make the community stronger and more viable.
This is yet another example of what I call relational physiology, which I've talked about before on this show, that our physicality is influenced by various relationships. And what you were saying about applying the term biodiversity now to include us. It's not something distant out there, but, you know, we are biodiverse. I think it's an interesting example of, this sense that the human is not just a bag of skin with a hard boundary. And, of course, spiritual teachings have said, no, that's not right. You coexist, you know, actually up to the level of an eco-cosmological self, certainly an ecological self. You coexist beyond your bag of skin. And there are energy fields or thought fields. And the materialists would say, yes, but we don't coexist in a material way. But as you say now, from the viewpoint of the human microbiome and this larger understanding of biodiversity, we sure do at the material level as well. So it's really fascinating, I think. It's a big turn in our cultural and intellectual history to realize this now.
And it's going on in all, Min Margulis, the late great biologist, she really was the person pushing that the self is really a multiple self. It's not just the self, our old sense of it. And, you know, as she and many others have pursued, we found things like glowing bacteria living inside an octopus in order to help it with its signaling for mating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we're seeing again and again two species actually coming together over the period of time, and that it isn't all just, you know, brute competition between species. The biggest leaps in evolution have always been endosymbiosis. Symbiosis. So, for instance, of course, chlorophyll inside all plants, it was actually a single cell that got inside another cell, but it wasn't eaten. It just began to live there and created plants.
Yeah, that was her breakthrough theory, wasn't it? That one cell just cozied up inside another, and bam, that's the beginning of complex life.
Right, exactly. And mitochondria, which are the thing that produced the energy of the body, were, again, another microbe that was eaten by another microbe, but instead of getting dissolved into nutrients, just lived inside it. And eventually they shared their DNA and still do to these days, creating all animal life that we know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the mental breakthrough. There's a lot of, in the material world, a lot of breakthroughs going on because of DNA, our understanding of DNA.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about. Some of these areas where you say, you know, people get into this mode of thinking through biodiversity, they end up in new places in their thinking. And what are some examples of that?
Well, the best I like is the American chestnut was wiped out. It was huge. I mean, it supported not only all the Native Americans, but, you know, there were descriptions of thousands and thousands of squirrels in one oak hickory chestnut forest. And people being able to just live off those squirrels. And then an invasive fungus came to the United States and wiped out all the chestnuts, but it didn't really kill them. It just forced them back into being growing a very small kind of strands or branches that could never grow back into a trunk in a tree. And so people have been trying to get the American chestnut back into the community by back-crossing it with a Chinese chestnut. And they got it back to about, maybe 15/16 of the old American chestnut, the other 16th being Chinese. But then some guy who was into gene splicing decided, what's causing this American chestnut not to grow? He found out it was a kind of oxalic acid that was hurting it. And then he found in the wheat that there's a gene that detoxes oxalic acid. So he just spliced 3 to 6 genes rather than close to 3,000, which was the back crossing with the Chinese, into the American chestnut and grew a new seed. And the seed with these 3 to 6 genes was completely grew into a tree, and we could completely revive the American chestnut exactly the way it was, except for 3 to 6 genes from wheat. And now the American Chestnut Society, this wonderful group of nuts for nuts, are replanting the whole southeast and part of New England with trees, and we should have the American chestnut back in, you know, 15 to 30 years. It'll be producing American chestnuts again. So what we're finding is that even though, you know, really horrible companies like Monsanto do bad things with gene splicing, that there are now ways to recover and restore trees. And, well, the northern white-lipped rhino is what I worked with. There are only 7 of them left on the planet. And so what they're trying to do, and 2 of them are females that are beyond giving birth, and so they're trying to get the whole genes of all the northern white-lipped rhino and put them into the egg of the closest white-lipped rhino, which is from South Africa, in the hope of now being able to have baby northern white-lipped rhinos with very few other genes from other groups and the species, which will go extinct in the next 10 years if this can't be done. So again, we're finding that, you know, just like some humans are having their babies in petri dishes, so is the northern white-lipped rhino, in order to save it. And there are a lot of others. The question is how far to go.
Yeah.
Should we try to revive the dodo, you know, the mammoth?
Slippery slope.
Yeah, it's a very slippery slope. And,
yeah.
The passenger...
because, of course, some people will say, then, you know, hell with it all. We can always bring them back later, which we don't want to do, destroying more habitat. Mm. Well, we just have about a minute left, but I wonder if you could say something about this, your sense of the oikos nomos, these economics and ecology.
Right. The people forget that economics means oikos nomos, which means the counting of life in the earth household, inside a household. And oikos logos for ecology means the governing principles, both in your mind and in nature, of how the household works.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start seeing that, or start thinking about economics as the counting of the household, then you're very much into biodiversity. You're understanding that certain things are are fewer and fewer, and other things are becoming more and more. So,
yeah.
You know, we can conceive of the future as dandelions. And
some people are counting with their own accounting sheets, alas. But yes, that is a deep and beautiful guiding principle, and so much of what you've arrived at, I think it opens our thinking, at least for me. Whenever I talk to you, I keep having more and more ideas spinning off this. So, Peter Warshall, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Sure. A pleasure, Charlene, after so many years.
Yeah. Okay, let's amble over to the Arts Corner, last one of the year, and we'll see what poem we have here. Well, today we have another one by Galway Connell. He's a former Poet Laureate of Vermont, a former MacArthur Fellow, and a winner of the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. This poem is from the collection published in 2006, entitled Strong Is Your Hold, which is a line from Walt Whitman. The poem is entitled Pure Balance by Galway Connell, and this contains an important life lesson for all of us. Pure balance. Wherever we are is unlikely. Our few kisses, I don't know if they're of goodbye or of what, or if she knows either. Neither do I understand why it's exhilarating, as well as all the other things it is, to know one doesn't have a future, or how much longer one won't have one. Future tramples all prediction. Hope loses hope. Clarity turns out to be an invisible form of sadness. We look for a bridge to cross to the other shore where our other could be looking for us. But all the river crossings, all the way to the sea, have been bombed. We look for a tree, touch it, touch right through it. Sometimes nowhere is there anything to hitch oneself to. And we must make our way by pure balance. This is so, and can't be helped without doing damage to oneself. Our song this week is by the great jazz singer Nancy Wilson, who just happens to be from my hometown, Columbus, Ohio. She has said that she knew when she was 4 years old she was going to be a singer. When she was a teenager, she won a citywide talent contest. The city was 1 million people. And then she got a TV show when she was in high school. Her debut single, Guess Who I Saw Today, was so successful that between April 1960 and July 1962, Capitol Records released 5 Nancy Wilson albums. And between spring 1964 and summer of the next year, 4 of those albums ranked by sales in the top 10. She's won 3 Grammy Awards, the first in 1964 for the rhythm and blues single, How Glad I Am, and 2 more in 2005 and 2007 for the best jazz vocal album. And folks, when she won those 2 Grammys for the best jazz vocal album a few years ago, she was around 70 years old, with her voice still beautiful. This song we're going to hear now was a big hit for Nancy Wilson in 1963, and I've been waiting all year to play it for you. It was written by Frank Lesser in 1947. The title is, What Are You Doing New Year's Eve?
Just the same. What are you doing New Year's? New Year's Eve. One those arms will hold you good and tight. When it's exactly 12 o'clock that night, welcoming in the new year, New Year's Eve. Maybe I'm crazy to suppose I'd ever be the one you chose out of a thousand invitations.
Was Nancy Wilson singing What Are You Doing New Year's Eve? In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who the guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Join me next week when my guest will be Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolen, who will be talking with us about her work with UN Women, the new organization at the United Nations. Till next time, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.